Hi again. 21 hours has zipped past. I was talking to someone else today who was mentioning how time seems to be going faster. It is going faster. I don't really know anybody who is observant of the world around them who isn't of that opinion. It's not just a sensory overload. I think there's more going on than that. Something else that perhaps our guest tonight will comment upon. In addition to talking about many other things, he is one of the most famous people on the planet when it comes to ancient history, ancient mysteries, and he has a brand new book out. He is Graham Hancock. He, of course, the author of the major international bestsellers, The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Heaven's Mirror. His books have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide and have been translated now into 27 different languages. His public lectures and TV appearances, including the three-hour series Quest for the Lost Civilization, have put his ideas before audience. Those are huge, tens of millions of people. He has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about humanity's history and its prehistory, which may be a lot more complex than most any of us realize, and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of orthodox scholars. Let's see if he's awake and up and at him now as we go live to the UK. Graham, are you there?
Hi, I'm there. I'm here. How are you?
I'm fine. The man who never sleeps, right?
That's what it's been feeling like recently.
That does. Your new book, Underworld, which is going to be another blockbuster, I think. Is it available in bookstores as we speak, or is it due?
Yes, it is.
It is out now. Okay.
It's available in bookstores throughout the U.S. In fact, I just finished my U.S. tour.
I know you were on a tour. I wasn't sure of the release date, though.
Yeah, it was released on about the 10th of October.
All right. Underworld.
Underworld, the Mysterious Origins of Civilization.
Now, when you folks are out looking for books, but more than that, the holiday season is upon us, and every year I mention good books to consider. This is certainly one to be put at the top of most any list, Underworld by Graham Hancock. You've spent a lot of time actually underwater yourself over the years, haven't you?
I have. I learned to dive in order to research and write this book. People who know my work will know that over the last more than 10 years, I've had a primary focus in my writing, which has been on the possibility of a huge forgotten episode in human history, of a lost civilization, perhaps more than one, going way back into what we think of as prehistoric time.
Almost dinosaur times, no?
Well, I don't see the need to push it back that far. The official picture we're painted is that what we call civilization, and therefore what makes us completely distinct and separate from other creatures on this planet, began about 5,500 years ago. What I'm trying to draw attention to is that in a period before that, not long before that, 7,000 or 8,000 years before that, the end of the Ice Age, about 12,000 years ago, such radical and dramatic things were happening to the Earth, that it's possible that an earlier layer of civilization, which we went into, and which was destroyed in these events at the end of the Ice Age, could have been hidden from us. And that this could explain many of the myths and traditions and strange hints of lost civilizations that are found throughout the world.
Graham, excuse me, these are more than hints. We have solid archaeological and geological pointers that would indicate such is the case.
Ask an archaeologist for that, and they'll say, no, it's not true.
I think all of us listening have a firm understanding of what orthodox science does and does not do in terms of entertaining unconventional ideas. They don't like to do it. But one has to only read your books or even the books of Michael Cremo. Hidden History of the Human Race.
Wonderful book,
absolutely, which points to solid geology in which have been found all sorts of anomalous items which are clearly crafted by an intelligent mind.
Yeah, this is really what I've been trying to do with Underworld, is to take this inquiry into the possibility of a lost civilization and everything that that means for our understanding of ourselves, to take it to a new level where it is directly supported by the kind of physical evidence that even the most extreme skeptics amongst the Orthodox archaeological crowd cannot ignore. And that's why it was important to look underwater. I mean, in brief, we have 600 flood myths from all around the world that speak of a great civilization.
You've counted 600 now.
Right. There are 600. Mm-hmm. There's about 578 that have been actually logged.
Sure.
All around the world that have this memory of a terrible cataclysm or a series of cataclysms, and before that, of a civilization which was advanced, which had achieved great things, but which was brought low by this cataclysm of flood, of sea level. And it is the case that at the end of the Ice Age, just before what we think of as the beginning of civilization, a few thousand years before it, there were terrible floods across the world, and sea level rose by 400 feet. And this is simply a vast amount of land that was swallowed up.
400 feet, yeah.
Well, 400 feet vertical rise in sea level actually means that all around the world's coastlines you lose more than 10 million square miles of land.
I wanted to ask you how much is lost, and if you can, now we have approximately 70% of the planet covered by water. What would the difference, just take a wild guess, been prior to whatever cataclysm hit us about 12,000 years ago? How much would the percentages reflect before the big flood? Any guess on that? Say.
Well, it's better to put it in concrete terms.
Okay.
Rather than in terms of percentages, that an area of land equivalent to the whole of South America, the whole of Central America, and the whole of the continental United States added together, that an area of land that large, which again is another example, is equivalent to the same size as China, all of China and all of Europe added together, that this much land went underwater around 12,000 to 15,000 years ago because of rising sea levels.
That's,
and this was the best land on Earth at that time.
The most arable land, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the warmest land, the most protected climate. Just remember that the Ice Age was a very mysterious period with terrible climatic conditions in the interior of continents. This is what you would expect with an ice cap 2 miles thick sitting on top of Northern Europe or North America. But out on the coastal margins where the land was exposed, where there was much more land than there is today, the climate was warmer, people had access to the resources of the sea, it was the ideal sort of environment.
Well, those were all the alluvial plains, too.
Yeah.
Those were all the alluvial plains, the best, richest land of all.
That's right, where the great rivers come down and deposit their silt in deltas. These were all swept away at the end of the Ice Age, and it's a kind of blind spot of archaeology. And I have felt, you see, that this debate about the possibility of a lost civilization, of a strange influence operating in human affairs going back long, long ago, has been one that's been going round and round and round in circles for at least the last 25 years. And although many on the alternative side, like myself and many others, feel that the evidence is compelling, that there has been a forgotten episode in human history and that we need to take this seriously and investigate what it means, although many of us feel it's compelling, mainstream science, which unfortunately blocks and controls all the solid research funds into this area, mainstream science is convinced that there was and could never have been any such thing as a lost civilization. So we need a breakthrough. We need to move on from the situation of two sides yelling at each other. One side saying, come on, you know, it doesn't make sense. We've got to understand our past better. And the other side saying, no, we've fully understood our past already.
Why don't we just leave them go and establish our own world of scientific endeavor and forget them? I don't think they're going to come along.
Well, I don't think they're going to come along either, but the problem is that in our society, the big bucks in research, in any endeavor of research to do with the human condition, rest with the mainstream universities and institutes. And, you know, frankly speaking, what we need to search the fascinating areas underwater all around the world that contain ruins, what we need is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of money that institutes like Woods Hole, Oceanographic Institute can mobilize and do mobilize for other research, and all I'm saying is it needs to be mobilized for this research as well. Otherwise, this debate between the so-called alternative and the mainstream will become completely sterile and fruitless and will just go on and on and nothing will ever be confirmed.
Yeah, I call it a denial. I don't even call it a debate anymore because these people are so entrenched, they literally will avert their eyes. I've had stories on this program of people holding up evidence, and these people actually will avert their gaze and not look at something offered to them.
Definitely. I have many critics of my work who say, you know, Graham Hancock's new book, Underworld, is complete crap from beginning to end. It's all fantasy and it's all made up. But they haven't read the book. They don't need to read the book because they're convinced already that everything I say is wrong. And so, as you say, it is indeed not any kind of dialogue. It is a denial.
Thank you. Stand by just a moment or two, Graham. We'll pause here and come right back with the remarkable Graham Hancock, my guest tonight. And do think about all that. Pick up Graham's book, Underworld. There is an entire history on this planet which is literally being denied to us for lack of funding. Think about that, too. It's all money, isn't it, folks? We shall continue. Graham Hancock's book's over 5 million sold, 27 different languages now. The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods and Heaven's Mirror. And now, the new one, in bookstores all around the country, Underworld, back in both countries. We're live in the UK. Graham Hancock is online. Just finished a major American book tour. Perhaps some of you even got to see and hear him. If you did, you were certainly fortunate. These two scientists who came across the unusual, I guess it was a sonar reading of some kind, side-scanning sonar something, Graham?
They were just to fill listeners in on the background to the story, although thankfully the story is becoming quite well known. A couple of years ago, the Cuban government decided to look into the possibility that its waters contain treasures. They were thinking of oil and gas, of course. They were thinking of sunken Spanish galleons that had looted Central American gold at the time of the conquest. They were thinking of all of this, and they gave concessions to 5 different marine salvage companies to search in different areas of Cuban waters. And one of these companies, ADC, which is a Canadian company, which has a very good track record in this kind of marine salvage work, were actually looking for oil and gas, and they were down very deep off Cabo San Antonio, off western Cuba, hauling behind the boat an instrument called side-scan sonar, which sends down sound waves to the seabed, and the returning echo allows us to construct a three-dimensional picture of what is on the seabed. It's rather accurate and state-of-the-art technique. And suddenly, their side-scan sonar, instead of sending back normal and expected images of the seabed around Cuba, at, I repeat, a depth of 2,200 feet, began to send back images of what seems to be whole city blocks, temples, structures that look ceremonial and designed, pyramid shapes, obelisks. The whole thing looked exactly like a city. But deep underwater and lost from human sight for thousands and thousands of years. And ADC were able to follow this up by sending down a remotely operated vehicle. 2,200 feet, by the way, is way too deep for any diver even to consider going. The deepest you can go on normal compressed air is about 120 feet.
Right.
And even with highly complex mixed gases, a diver rarely goes deeper than 400 or 500 feet. So a depth of 2,200 feet is stunning. So the next step was to send down a remotely operated vehicle with a camera. And again, this returned intriguing images of huge regular blocks piled on top of one another, lying on the seabed, and of structures that did look like pyramids and obelisks. So the first evidence from this site is extremely intriguing. Now, of course, we mentioned earlier, we're surrounded by a universe of scientists who just want to be convinced that there is no magic or mystery anywhere in the past. So instead of the first response of scientists around the world being one of active enthusiasm and interest in this discovery, the first response universally was to try to debunk it, to say that no, it's not of interest, it's of no value, we don't want to know about this, it's just natural phenomena. But ABC continued their work. They've had some backing from mainstream geologists now who accept that this does not look like anything that one should find on the seabed. National Geographic are flirting with putting some money into it, and it may be that discovery of some length in Underworld, I think it's very important to illustrate the general point, which is that around our coastlines, underwater, in areas that no research has ever been done, we can expect to find ruins and remains which will force us to completely rethink our whole picture of the past of the human race.
Okay, well that brings
that's
us...
what Cuba looks like. Right, that's what it looks like right now.
Okay, all right, that brings us to the obvious conundrum then. Where does organized science go with something like this? Let's say the evidence does indicate unquestionably that something of very great intelligence lies at 2,200 feet below the water. That really does throw all the history books out the window. Are they going to allow that to happen, Graham? Are we to a point now where can they successfully suppress something like this?
This is where I hope that shows like yours, books like mine, the growing awareness amongst the general public that new information is coming out, which is forcing us to rethink the past. This is where I hope that the more democratic environment that we live in now concerning information, where it's possible for you and I to have a conversation like this, and people to listen to it and feel that there's some point to it, that this will change the balance, and that mainstream science will be forced to go on the record and recognize what this discovery is. You can be sure that there will be every attempt to debunk and discredit the discovery, but sooner or later, if it is what it seems to be, then it's going to come out. I'm convinced of that.
2,200 feet. If the seas rose 400 feet, there is 1,800 feet missing somewhere.
Yeah, that's the fascinating and major problem with the Cuba issue. Now, I mean, my view is that if we want to understand the flood traditions from all around the world and these memories of a lost civilization, then the answer is going to lie underwater, and that we have the events at the end of the Ice Age which account for a massive loss of land and a 400-foot rise in sea level. But as you say, this Cuban site is even deeper than that, 2,200 feet. How did it get down? It's not just sea level 10 or 12,000 years ago that accounts for the submergence of this. Something else happened as well, and perhaps we're talking about a gigantic earthquake or a landslide that carried this material down to a much greater depth.
In that one particular location.
In that one particular location.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And who's to say it didn't happen in others? Because, again, if you go back to the mythology, to the stories that everybody's heard of, the story of Atlantis, which is peculiarly appropriate to this discovery because the Cuban discovery is in the right kind of area for that mysterious place that the Greek philosopher Plato called Atlantis. Now, the Atlantis story, quite clearly, as it was passed down to us by Plato, includes a description not only of a gigantic global flood, but also of it being accompanied by tremendous earthquakes and a submergence of land. So I think that precisely the kind of conditions that are described in the myths, and which science now confirms, did afflict our ancestors at the end of the Ice Age. In other words, huge sea level rises and the collapse of land masses into the sea. Precisely those kind of conditions would explain this Cuban anomaly, and put before us something that previously there has never been, which is incontrovertible evidence, absolutely solid, definite evidence that nobody can deny of a lost civilization. We're a long way from that yet, but we're heading in the right direction. There's enough of general awareness about this discovery and other discoveries that I draw attention to in Underworld. For example, discoveries again of what appear to be two major cities off the northwest coast of India. All of this is beginning to come into context now, and I don't believe that people will accept for it just to be ignored by mainstream science.
We'll talk more about India and the recent satellite photographs of what appears to be a long land bridge. Some people have tried to debunk that already, but we'll see what Graham Hancock has to say about that. Just think about it. 2,200 feet below the sea, maybe a massive land subsidence, some other kind of catastrophe dropped it further. But go on the other extreme, to the heights of Machu Picchu. The range, the physical range and height of apparent ancient civilizations was extraordinary, put it mildly. We shall pause, and then we'll be right back. I'm Jeff Rentz with Graham Hancock. It has been said by more than one scientist and researcher that about 4,000 years ago, the Earth's natural magnetic field was about 4 Gauss, G-A-U-S-S, Gauss being a measurement of magnetic field strength, like watts to a light bulb, if you will. But now the Earth's natural magnetic field is only 4/10 of 1 Gauss, a 90% reduction over a very short period of time, geologically speaking, of just 4,000 years ago. There, of course, is ample evidence to suggest that there have been relatively routine magnetic, if not physical, pole shifts. And if there are such things as physical pole shifts, I would suggest that we have an explanation as to how that 2-mile-thick sheet of ice might have been brought very quickly into a much warmer climate, encouraging massive melting over a very short period of days or weeks. Graham, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously one of the best ways to explain the truly cataclysmic nature of the events that occurred at the end of the Ice Age. Indeed, the recognition that the end of the Ice Age was a cataclysmic time is still in the process of dawning on scientists around the world. As more and more research is done, it's becoming more and more clear that particular 10,000-year period between roughly 17,000 and 7,000 years ago was a period of horrendous cataclysm.
And yet they have had for years, Graham Hancock, the issue of mammoths found with food still in their mouths from climbs and so on and so
forth. Indeed, and this should have been raising alarm bells a long time ago. Again, what happens with finds like that is that the scientific community turns on them and tries to find every way to minimize their impact and their implications.
Sure.
To suggest that this was mammoths that were killed at widely different periods and so on. But again, if you just come back to the basic thing that the scientists do accept, which is a 70% extinction of animal species at the end of the Ice Age and more than 10 million square miles of land covered by water, you realize that you are talking about a cataclysm. And then you have to ask yourself, what is the normal state of our Earth? What is the stable state of our Earth? And frankly, the stable state of our Earth seems to be not how it is now. It seems to be indeed locked in an ice age, that we've had many ice ages in the past, long, long periods when the Earth was just literally frozen solid. But every now and then something comes along and interrupts this.
There is also in the ancient history of mythology and folklore the story of a time when the planet became so hot that people had to retreat to caves, and it was so hot outside that
indeed,
when they were to stick a branch out through a crack in whatever doorway they had managed to fashion that branch would actually ignite into flames. That's how hot things got.
Yeah.
Which does mitigate for a potential meteor impact of some kind.
Well, that's the other issue. I mean, what we're looking for is the trigger factor, which causes these stabilized sheets to melt down, and which then radically changes the appearance of the world. There's no doubt that the two strongest suggestions are a displacement of the crust of the Earth, of the mantle of the Earth, if you will, or an asteroid strike or a comet strike. And again, it's becoming obvious that there have been more and more of these events in the past.
Oh, yes.
Than we previously realized.
We continually finding new evidence of enormous cratering under the oceans and so forth.
That's right. And in a way, that pinpoints the problem with this whole argument over our past and whether there could have been lost civilizations, which is that scientists claim to have full knowledge of everything that concerns us, often on the basis of only very partial and limited information. And, you know, what's needed on the part of science is a recognition that new information can come along any day, which will completely change the picture of our history. And what's becoming clear now, whatever the cause, is that cataclysms have played a much bigger role in human history than we have allowed for in our understanding of the past. That we are, in a sense, perhaps our evolution and development as a species is driven by cataclysms. Perhaps cataclysms play a crucial role for us, not something that we should simply turn our back on and ignore,
right,
but something that we should study and try to understand what it is about cataclysms that seems to lead to jumps forward.
Well, in a microcosm, you can look at any normal cataclysm, be it an earthquake or a massive hurricane, that brings the best out of human beings
in many ways.
So I mean, you can take it from a moral standpoint or a scientific standpoint, and there is always advance after tragedy.
It makes people think again and to reconsider what they're doing and how perhaps to do it better in the future. I mean, it's odd that in this enormous quantity of myths and traditions from around the world that speak of the destruction of a former civilization, virtually every one of these ancient traditions associates it in some way with the behavior of that civilization.
True.
It isn't just a blind environmental accident. It's also, we have done something. This is how it's always portrayed in the traditions, whether it's the story of Noah, the story of Atlantis, so many of the flood myths from around the world. We have done something. The human race has done something. We've reached too high. We've aspired to become gods. And this leads to a punishment being unleashed upon us. This is too widespread a tradition to be completely ignored, I believe.
It's amazing how science has been co-opted, controlled, and otherwise really, I think, put into almost a box by corporate and political interests, financial, of course, at the bottom line of all of it. But there are certainly religious factors as well. And science to us, As children, we're grown up thinking that scientists are on the forefront, they're fluid, they're always looking for new and creative ways to reinterpret our reality. But really, the contrary is the truth in many cases, unfortunately.
Well, I think it's important to remember that these scientists we're talking about are human beings just like us, with human emotions and
mortgages to pay.
And their own particular prejudices and their own particular abilities. And I always like to pay tribute to science and even to mainstream archaeology, because there's no doubt that a vast amount of wonderful groundwork has been done. And I couldn't do my work. I don't think anybody working in the alternative field could do their work if it wasn't for that big basis of knowledge that has been set up by mainstream scientists. So it's not that they're necessarily all bad or wicked people. The fact is that particularly in archaeological science, you're looking at people who are so convinced that they are right that they just cannot imagine anything else being the case.
And how many things, Graham Hancock, are put in crates and sequestered away?
I think an enormous number. I mean, I've had the privilege, for example, to handle a little piece of iron, a few inches square, that is the remains of an iron plate that once blocked the northern shaft of the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid. The southern shaft of the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid. And this iron sheet, which was removed during excavations in the 19th century, since that time has been sitting in a drawer in the British Museum in London. I and my colleague Robert Bovall had to go to the British Museum and exert quite a lot of force and energy and pull many strings in order to actually get that amazing piece of iron just relocated in the British Museum's archive. And it was eventually found sitting in a drawer where it seemed not to have been moved for more than 100 years. And what's bizarre about this iron piece is that it doesn't fit at all with the Iron Age, with what we think of as the time of the invention of iron. It's a huge discovery, and yet it's completely ignored.
Would perhaps the most dramatic relics at Giza extend back beyond that catastrophe? Is it possible that we're looking at things that did survive whatever happened? And
I think we are. I think Giza is a very complicated site. And if nothing else, the debate over Giza in the last 10 years has helped to make that clear to everybody, that we're dealing with a very complex phenomenon in the case of the three great pyramids and the great Sphinx.
Do we also think possibly, Graham, and I've discussed it on the program in the past, but the lesser pyramids, the Step Pyramid and others, were poor reflections of the great pyramids that were constructed long ago by peoples that came along afterwards?
Well, here's the weird thing. If the official chronology is accepted, the chronology that's published in all the archaeology and history books, then the Great Pyramid was preceded only by three other pyramids, really. And we're supposed to believe that in a period of 150 years and the construction of three pyramids, the ancient Egyptians acquired all the necessary skills to build something so extraordinary and remarkable as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Whereas
and then promptly lost their skills.
That evolutionary development is just not there on the ground.
And then promptly lost those skills.
Exactly. And then it stops and goes into reverse. So we have this one isolated period, supposedly around 2500 BC, when the most amazing structures that mankind has ever created are being raised up on the deserts of Egypt. And then both before it and after it, we have very inferior pyramids being built, which seem to belong to a different, almost to a different culture.
So you do feel that the inferior pyramids bookend the magnificent one?
I think that's
the official chronology anyway.
Yes, it is the official chronology, but is there something about it that just doesn't make sense?
There's a lot about it that doesn't make sense. Indeed.
It doesn't make sense at all. It's not what we'd expect to see, and it's these missing chunks from the archaeological record, just huge areas of human history that are not represented at all.
No, they're mighty big chunks indeed. And we have, of course, in America, evidence up and down the Mississippi River of potentially ancient Phoenicians, ancient Egyptians visiting here. Egyptians of our time, with hieroglyphs and all the rest of it. Things have been found in caves which knock the socks off people who take a good look at things. Hold on, we'll be right back with Graham Hancock in just a moment. Jeff Ress with Graham Hancock. Graham, before we go back underworld, let's talk about Machu Picchu. Do we have, in your estimation, a good date lock on that yet?
Well, you see, it's a problem. Machu Picchu is a site I've been to many times. It's a remarkable place. And I think that the key to the mystery of Machu Picchu is, like many ancient sites, Giza included, is that it was built on in two quite different periods. That there was a very early period of occupation of the site, which we see characterized by megalithic architecture with gigantic blocks of stone. And particularly with rock-hewn architecture, where structures are actually carved out of solid rock.
Right.
And then we have a later period of occupation, which is within the time frame of normal history, by the Inca culture, somewhat before and during the conquest of Peru by the Spaniards from 1530 onwards. We have a later period of occupation of the same site. And I think that what's happened is that that archaeology has focused on the later period of occupation and has not recognized the possibility of an earlier period of occupation there. So it's possible that the site could actually date from two periods, one of them very old and one of them more recent. And I think it's the same story as Giza. I think that's why there's so much confusion there.
Makes perfect sense. But the
site was originally occupied by a culture that made gigantic stone monuments, rock-hewn monuments, and that the site was completed at a later date by another culture, which perhaps was closely related to the first culture, descended from the first culture, but nevertheless different and in a later period of time. So we have a lot of evidence from 2500 BC around the Giza site, but that does not mean that the whole of Giza was constructed in 2500 BC, because there is other evidence, the well-known evidence of the Sphinx and of the alignment of the structures, which suggests a much earlier date. And I think it's the same at Machu Picchu. In fact, in many ways, in the highlands of South America, in the Altiplano around the Andes, with cities like Tiwanaku and of course Cusco in Peru. This is the picture of an earlier titanic epoch of construction by a forgotten civilization, which is memorialized in the myths and traditions of the region.
Certainly, and the images at Nazca now, most Americans know them from pictures of them. There are literally hundreds, maybe thousands more of them carved all over the mountains going back for dozens and dozens of square miles.
Indeed. I mean, the scale of the thing is
it's just huge.
It's just epic. It's absolutely epic. And as you say, more and more is being discovered or rediscovered every day. So to answer your question on Machu Picchu, I think it is a very old site. But I think that it was reclaimed by the Incas in the Inca period, and that's why we see this character to it.
Very logical, very pragmatic. All right, underworld. Now, about 4 years ago now, 5 years ago maybe, Laura Lee on her website broke those pictures of the underwater, what do you call them, ruins off Okinawa.
Yeah. I have to say, I have to just claim a little bit of credit here, because I was actually the first Western diver ever to dive at the monuments underwater.
It wasn't a Japanese diver.
No, I was the first Western diver to dive there.
Yeah, well, they're West.
In 1997, which was before the story began to really get out in the West. I actually learned to dive in 1996, and the reason that I learned to dive was because I'd been traveling in Japan extensively in 1996.
And heard about that.
And I had heard about these structures, and a photojournalist called Ken Shindo had shown me photographs that he'd taken underwater off the Okinawa island of Yonaguni, which is the most southwestern of all the Japanese islands, which showed this huge terraced structure, very dramatic structure, deeply submerged underwater. And I decided I have absolutely got to see this. And I found that no Westerners, a number of Japanese had dived there, but no Westerners had ever taken an interest in it. So I decided to do that, and I learned to dive in 1996, and then started diving at Yonaguni in March of 1997. And since then, I've put in more than 200 dives on the underwater structures around Yonaguni.
Rather treacherous waters, I understand.
They're very treacherous waters. And you see, for me, it started off with a sense of curiosity. What could this thing be? And developed into a need to explore this massively extensive site, because we've heard very little in the West about really how big and extraordinary the Yonaguni site is. So obviously I cover it in depth in Underworld. My intention was to really show the complexity and the peculiarities of this site.
What is the depth of it again, Graham?
Well, the deepest parts that we have dived on go down to about 120 feet underwater. However, that doesn't mean that there are not deeper structures. We went there in 99 with a remotely operated vehicle, and we found other structures at much greater depth, which has not been possible to dive on yet. The whole area is just littered with extraordinary underwater ruins. And again, I mean, I'm sorry to keep on moaning about the scientists, but again, what science has done in response to the Yonaguni discoveries has been to try to dismiss them as purely natural, freak natural phenomena.
They did the same thing with the underwater square blocks off Bimini.
They did the same thing with those blocks off Bimini, which I also re-examine in the book, because I think the so-called debunking of the Bimini Road is a classic example of really appalling science.
Appalling. It's not science.
It's not science at all. No. It's a pure instrument of prejudice. Designed to take our attention away from an interesting and intriguing possibility in the past. Well, the same so-called debunking exercise was mounted on Yonaguni, so I've made it my business to put together in a detailed and logical form all the evidence which proves that the whole complex of structures of Yonaguni are man-made.
Bravo.
And that they go back more than 12,000 years.
Bravo. Guide. It's all in the book Under. Fabulous book. Be right back with Graham in just a couple minutes. I was just thinking about several things. We'll get to those after our break here. Running a little bit late, so let's run. And welcome back. Great honor to have Graham Hancock with us tonight. We're hearing all sorts of fascinating things. His new book is simply a must. I want you to really make a note of this. When you go out to the bookstores, if you're online at Amazon.com, any of those, Graham Hancock, Underworld. Underworld, Graham Hancock, and because he takes us under it all. And under all of what we see are quite clearly the foundations and remnants of a very advanced civilization. It's interesting how some people try to debunk, to besmirch these ruins. I've read a few of them. I read some works of, I don't know who, about Yonaguni, and they're trying to talk about tidal flows and all sorts of bizarre. It's junk science. It's screwball.
Extraordinary junk science by people who've never dived there at all, or who've only done a handful.
Well, they're
of
just
dives.
As bad as people who criticize your books and never read them. Same thing.
It's the same kind of thing, that there's this smug attitude of we know everything on the part of mainstream science, which is then transferred to the public as though it were a fact. Actually, they don't know everything. They just think they know everything. And the only encouraging thing is the public are becoming increasingly tired of all this nonsense. Can I mention my website, grahamhancock.com?
Please.
Yeah, www.grahamhancock.com. We have a message board on the site, and it's often a focus for discussions around these issues. And you know, it's the most curious thing that when my site started to become popular, immediately so-called debunking sites were set up to attack it. And
yeah.
You know, I don't understand what all this energy is in so-called debunking.
A few
alternative ideas put out there,
yeah.
And suddenly the establishment of academic history is crying that it's being attacked and that it's not fair and that the false view is being given of the past, whereas in fact, 70 or 80, perhaps 90% of all media output on the past is absolutely mainstream and orthodox.
Sure
and never asks any questions at all.
Sure it is.
And, you know, if there's to be any balance, yeah, I mean, we need alternative ideas put forward, even if a lot of them are wrong.
What?
That's what we need in our society, is some intelligent inquiry.
My question, why and how is it whenever someone like yourself puts up a truly valuable, important, unduplicatable body of knowledge on a website, that something is put up almost immediately to try to dump on it? I'm wondering if there's not some money somewhere in some kind of a black fund that puts these sites on the internet.
I think there is.
That's conspiracy.
I think it is funded.
It has to be. Coincidence wouldn't allow for every single one of these things to pop up as they do. It just wouldn't happen.
No, not at all. It's funded, and it's because powerful groups have an investment, an absolute investment in a passive consuming public, which does not ask questions,
sure.
But simply consumes goods of mass production. And anything which threatens the passivity of the public and the inquiry into our past and what we are and where we came from does so to an extraordinary degree. Anything that threatens that status quo is crushed. And we've seen this again and again,
sure.
with ideas that have been put forward. And all kinds of dirty tricks are used.
Oh, yeah.
Which suggests that the other side, if we may call them that, must have something that they're covering up or are afraid of.
No question about it. None at all. It's quite a nice picture of you, sir. You look like a Shakespearean actor. I'm just looking.
Sometimes I feel like a Shakespearean character as well, out of place in time, but you know.
You have a worldwide following of respect from people who are.
It's good. It's growing.
Yeah.
It's growing. And I don't think it's so much a following of me and my work. I think it's a new phenomenon in the world that people are. Despite all the efforts being made to cage us in, that independent-minded people all around the world are thinking for themselves.
There is a layer of that. There is a.
Yeah.
I'm going to call them the new intelligentsia.
Yeah.
They are awakening. They are questioning,
definitely.
And more than that, they are embracing and assimilating remarkable knowledge, which people like you, the few of you who are really out there doing the work, are making possible.
Yeah.
Now this layer of new intelligentsia. Let's just speak of the UK and the US. I don't know where to assign a percentage number. I used to think it was maybe 15, maybe 20%, but now I'm a little concerned that I'm way over optimistic on this because of the successful dumbing down of the American populace, where
yes.
Most of our high school students now are they're on the border of functional illiteracy. I'm thinking now it's maybe a hardcore 3-5% on a real good day. That's the way it looks.
I would agree with you on that. I think that's about right. It's in the 4-5% range.
And that's why we are allowed to do what we do. If it were 15-20%, I think frankly, we would be by one means or another put off the radar.
Taken off the air. Yeah, I agree. That's exactly what would happen. One can only hope that this new spirit of inquiry continues to gather momentum.
Even if it stays in the 3-4% range, fine. Let's keep those people nurtured.
Yes.
Let's keep them moving forward, because maybe...
That's a substantial block of people.
That's
you know?
Right, because maybe if there is some kind of a major cataclysm, geopolitically speaking, these people will be the ones who are armed and ready with the knowledge to step forward into the void and maybe lead what's left.
Yes.
into a true dawn of enlightenment and kindness on the planet. Let's
absolutely
think.
This is the best the best hope possible in my view that could happen, and that somehow, you know, that people would go on asking questions. The most insidious thing about modern society is the way that it tells us, whatever the field is, whether it's medicine, whether it's physics, whether it's ancient history, our society conspires to persuade us that everything is already known about it, and that there's nothing new to discover, and that alternative ideas are not helpful.
What was the guy in the U.S. Patent Office in America, close to a century ago, who said that everything basically worth inventing has been invented? Remember that? He's the guy who actually said that.
It's an extraordinary thing to say,
isn't
it? Yeah. It's just the most extraordinary thing to say, and yet, unfortunately, it sums up the scientific answer.
And then we look at the work of the unbridled genius of a man, the man out of time, the man known as Nikola Tesla.
Yes.
And there are people like that that come along occasionally who are in quantum measurements ahead of their peers by a century or two or
definitely.
Three. And you'd say, well, we have, as a species, hope. There is hope because of people like Tesla.
Exactly. We occasionally get these glimpses of the true range of human potential.
Right.
We were talking to 3% or 4% of people thinking in a new way, but I would say it's also the case that we probably just use about 3% or 4% of our brain.
It's amazing.
The rest of it is unplumbed.
Untouched, untapped. Some would suggest, Graham Hancock, that 90-plus% of our brains, which we don't have apparent ready access to, was blocked off at some point in the past through some kind of a genetic tool, a device.
Yes.
That argument has been made rather compellingly by some.
I'm open to such ideas, because otherwise I find it very hard to explain.
Well, it's a logical world, and it should be anyhow.
You know, we have this fantastic potential to imagine anything, and to reach out with our imaginations into the mystery of being alive, and the mystery of the soul and of the meaning of life and of life after death. These questions are within our potential to examine them, and yet modern society encourages us not only not to examine them, but also that they're not worth examining.
And in some cases, organized science will punish those who do.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Organized science has without a doubt, become the sad and miserable religion of the modern age.
Well, they've become the lapdogs of the grant givers and international multi-corporate entities.
That's a whole other story.
Sure.
The funding behind research.
Look at the vilification of people like Crookes and others just in the last century.
Mm-hmm.
That go on, and it just
look at Benikovsky.
We've done programs on him too.
Ruined for what? For simply putting forward ideas that questioned the vision of the past.
Wilhelm Reich, another modern martyr.
Yeah.
On and on and on. Underworld, the book. I remember the first time I read in some magazine somewhere the scientific debunking of those Bimini blocks, and I wasn't very sophisticated then. But it just didn't ring true, and I actually laughed. I said, these people are absurd.
Yeah.
There's no way currents did that. Perfect geometric precision didn't happen.
Yeah, and there's so much more to the story. I decided to... The story of Underworld is spread out all around the world, but one of the sites that I do visit and dive at and re-examine is the famous Bimini Road, because here is an example of an intriguing discovery. Which was successfully written off by science almost 30 years ago. By the early 70s, the view had become so widespread that there was no point in doing further research at Bimini, that really hardly anybody did, certainly not mainstream research. So I tried to re-examine this and to show that the Bimini Road is part of something much, much larger, which is to do with the Ice Age character of the Grand Bahama Banks. Today, Bimini is just a tiny island, but down until as recently as about 8,000 years ago, it was a massive landmass, hundreds of feet above the sea, which is all now flooded. And when we take that into account, we can see that the few remaining structures of the Bimini Road are part of something much larger that once covered the whole area.
People often raise the issue, we've got about a minute left till this next break, that, gee whiz, if there had been an advanced civilization, we would find ruins of it all over the place. And yet I remember talking years ago with Michael Cremo, who was one of the first people to make it quite clear that what we call primitive building technology wouldn't last 100 years under normal nature. It would just decay and fall apart.
Right.
90% of it would be gone. Automobiles would rust. Computers would fall apart. It would be, the slate would be essentially wiped clean in half a millennium.
And there are geological processes. The meltdown of an ice cap, the grinding of a huge ice cap over the land underneath it,
scrubs
operates like an eraser. It just rubs out the previous traces.
Precisely. All right, we're going to break and come back next hour. If some of you folks would like to call in and talk to Graham Hancock, we'll take a few calls next hour. 800-876-4123. 800-876-4123. Or you can email your questions directly to me. I'll be online watching at jr@rents.com. The book is Underworld. It is a great book from a great mind and a great researcher. Be right back. Hour number three with Graham Hancock, live on the phone from the UK. He was over here in the States. When you were in the States on your book tour for Underworld, Graham, how did you feel the pulse of America? How did it seem to you?
Actually, it was very interesting experience for me. Of course, I've been traveling in the U.S. for many years, and it's a country very, very dear to my heart. It was a very interesting experience for me to travel in the U.S. this time. I had not been back to the U.S. since September the 11th, and to travel in the U.S. now with this whole question of a war with Iraq looming was a very illuminating experience for me, and I'll tell you why. Because over here in Europe, the media tend to portray America as only having one mind on this issue, which is the mind of George Bush.
And au contraire.
And exactly. That's what I discovered. And it was great to see this, that, for example, in Washington, D.C. and in San Francisco, huge demonstrations taking place where literally hundreds of thousands of people are out on the street saying, actually, we don't agree with everything George Bush says.
Sure.
And it reminded me again of the powerful vitality of America and how this is the most, this willingness to tolerate differences of opinion is the most precious gift that America has, and how you're absolutely right that this gift is being run down and drained away, seemingly just completely needlessly, by the way things are going at the moment. But it was wonderful for me to see that there is a real debate, at least in American society, about this matter, and that people feel strongly about it and want to think about what's going on. And it quite contradicted the view we get in the European media, which suggests that America is just of one mind on this. Suddenly you are reminded that America is a nation full of hundreds of millions of human beings who are thinking independently and have their own views on matters. I mean, unfortunately, I think a lot of people don't think independently. That's true in every society. But it reminded me that there is good health still there in America, and that alternative views do have a possibility of making themselves heard in America.
They do, but they don't have access to the mainstream media, which has been, of course, monopolized by a handful of mega corporations who have their own goals and ideas about what Americans should be allowed to say in the public media and should not. Then we have the issue of the polls in America, which have been dismissed by most intelligent people as being nothing less than tools of vulgar manipulation. And on from there.
It's
unfortunate, but most Americans have been shut out of the process by the media, which is abjectly controlled in most instances.
It is very much the case. I'm very conscious of that, of how the media, the mainstream media, which are a huge channel of information for the public, of how they have a sort of gatekeeper system at work, which simply cuts out a massive discussion. I mean, to come back to our topic, this is true in the field of ancient history as well. One of the most insidious organizations which actually began life in America, I'm sure you're very familiar with PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which its membership is mainstream and often very major scientists, and its agenda is to destroy at the point of outset any alternative thinking on any subject that concerns science. It's not a balanced and objective investigation and weighing up of new information. It is, in fact, something that is designed to destroy new thinking before it begins. And what I find very insidious and contrary to freedom of speech and contrary to everything that is good about the American way is the fact that PSYCHOP, this committee of scientists, has directly influenced the media so massively that, for example, the science editors of all the major newspapers, even in the UK, are members of PSYCHOP.
Oh, really?
Now, yes, they are. Now, this means that because they are, by becoming members of PSYCHOP, they have got the PSYCHOP agenda, and that means that such science editors will never allow into the newspaper at all any information that contradicts the mainstream view. Otherwise, they wouldn't be members of PSYCHOP. And PSYCHOP says it seeks to influence the media to cut down on programming that covers so-called paranormal and unusual events.
Now, they also call themselves skeptics, and the word skeptic is not defined by any means, I understand.
It's a much abused word.
Yeah.
That somebody can claim to be a skeptic. Where we need skepticism is for it to be directed against the overwhelming mainstream model of our world. That's where it's needed. We don't need skepticism being focused so much on alternative ideas. We need it being focused on the mainstream idea, which is so much unquestioned in our society. But again, you know, the clever manipulation of the media, the use of certain words and ideas with emotional weight is a technique that is used to just shut down thinking on so many different areas.
Indeed. The book I first came across that really amazed me was Fingerprints of the Gods.
Thank you. I mean, this was.
It's truly a landmark book, Graham.
Thank you.
Amazing.
It was a landmark book in my life. I had no idea where that book was going to go when I set out to write it, or what was going to happen to it, or the impact that it would have around the world, or the firestorm that it would bring down on my head from mainstream science around the world. But I felt, and this was back in 1995 that The Prince of the Gods was published, I felt that what was needed was a book that would passionately advocate this neglected possibility, with all that it implies, of a lost civilization deep in prehistory. And that's what I set out to write with Fingerprints of the Gods. In a sense, Underworld is the true follow-up to that. Because it's moving it beyond the advocacy, one-sided advocacy of that idea, and into the presentation of evidence that I hope can help to shift our whole picture of our past. So the two books, Underworld Today and Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995, 1996, are intimately linked. I don't cover the same ground in the two books. They both cover entirely different ground, but they both focus on the same problem. And Fingerprints advocates the need to consider the possibility of a lost civilization. And Underworld, I hope, presents the evidence that really requires this investigation to be taken up by the mainstream. I want to get this subject out of the New Age shelves in bookshops.
Critically important to do that.
Yeah, it belongs in the mainstream, and I tried to show that there are logical and common sense reasons. We don't have to appeal to anything outside the understanding of mainstream science. It's all there already in mainstream science to suspect that there have been forgotten episodes of human history, and that's simply because of the enormous amount of land that was lost to the rising.
I was just going to mention that you read my mind. Our listeners who may have tuned in a little bit late, I'd like to revisit that if I can in our third hour here. The amount of land that essentially vanished from the venue that human habitation was so accustomed to for such a long time was not just a little bit along the coastlines, was an enormous amount of land on the planet. I mean, we look at the Earth now from space, we see photos of it, we know it as a water world, possibly 70% water, 30% land, or thereabout. The amount of land that disappeared virtually overnight was how much again?
In sort of plain statistics, it's more than 10 million square miles, and that has to be understood in practical terms as a continent-sized landmass, a landmass bigger than the whole of South America, bigger than China and Europe added together, which was simply lost to our ancestors.
Just amazing.
When the sea levels rose at the end of the Ice Age. Now, if all that land were concentrated together into one continent, which would half fill the Pacific Ocean, for example, or which would run from the North Pole to the South Pole, if it were all gathered together in one continent, filling the Atlantic Ocean, we would obviously feel that it was important to do some research on it. But because it is distributed around the world in these often very extensive coastal plains, for example, the east coast of China extended 700 miles further into the sea 10,000 years ago than it does today. Taiwan, today an island, 10,000 years ago was joined to mainland China. Mm-hmm. And it's these huge losses of land that make, for example, the Japanese underwater monuments that are one of the subjects I dive on and examine in depth in Underworld that makes them so important. Take the case of the Persian Gulf, which everybody's heard of the Fertile Crescent. We all know, or think we know, that the earliest historical civilizations sprang up there in the area which is now modern Iraq, the ancient civilization of Sumer. Now, the ancient civilization of the Sumerians had a very powerful flood myth. They said that thousands of years earlier than them, there had been a great civilization that had built five huge antediluvian cities. And then, once again, the familiar story that gods come and they send a flood, and those cities are swallowed up. Now, archaeologists react to this tradition by saying, nah, nonsense, there's no such thing as antediluvian cities, but nobody has looked at the bottom of the Persian Gulf. The whole of the Persian Gulf was dry land until 12,000 years ago.
Okay, we'll pause and come right back. Graham Hancock, I'm going to ask him about Lemuria, the legendary civilization off the west coast of South America, at least according to most accounts I've read, and more as we continue. If you'd like to call in, 800-876-4123, Mr. Graham Hancock. Okay, Graham Hancock, what about Lemuria, or as it is fondly known by many, Mu, N-U, off the coast, allegedly, of South America? What do you know about that?
Well, what I have to say about Mu partly relates to the way that I carry out my own work. I place great significance on ancient mythology and ancient traditions and on the possibility that these so-called myths could be true. Therefore, if I were able to find a genuinely ancient myth from a genuinely ancient culture that referred to a place called Mu, I would be very interested. However, I'm absolutely certain now, having been involved in this research for many years, that no such ancient record of a place called Mu exists. I think that Mu is a relatively modern myth, and we have to trace it back to the work of Auguste Plongeon, who mistranslated Maya texts in the 19th century, and of James Churchward as well, who wrote a series of books on Mu, substantially based on the mistranslations done by Le Plongeon. I think, to mix metaphors a little bit, I think that Mu is something of a red herring, because we cannot find an ancient account that speaks of a land called Mu. It's something that's been invented in the last 100 or 150 years. It doesn't alter the fact that there were enormous land masses in the Pacific Ocean, enormous land masses, which were above water during the Ice Age, and which are submerged today. All of the great Pacific islands, some of which I dived on in the research for Underworld, were much larger in the past. Take Tonga, for example, or Samoa. These islands were all much bigger than they are today. The whole of the Ryukyu Archipelago, the Okinawa Islands of Japan, where so many extraordinary underwater ruins have been found, were much larger than they are today. So there's no doubt that that science tells us that large land masses were lost in the Pacific. There are many myths from the Pacific area, whether it's from Oceania or from China or from Japan or Taiwan, that speak of a great flood and the destruction of a former civilization, but none of them call it Mu. That's my problem with Mu, that I don't find the ancient testimony for it, and I feel it's very important to keep this investigation grounded and not to go off into areas which just invite our critics to destroy the argument. And I'm afraid that Mu, for me, is one of those areas.
I wonder, with all the work that has been done to this point in time, with the discoveries made, explored by people like you, what it will take to overturn this scientific mindset that anything new, anything out of the box must be somehow suppressed. How much is it going to take, Graham? What will really...
I think we're actually at the point of a breakthrough. I think we're on the very edge of it. It's that frustrating time when the evidence is mounting and it's still not being accepted by the mainstream, but we're very nearly there. The Cuban discovery that we discussed earlier, which will definitely be reinvestigated next year, and new information will be provided, and the discoveries that I've been involved in off India are in themselves enough to overturn the existing picture of prehistory. Two huge cities have been revealed at a depth of more than 100 feet underwater in the Gulf of Cambay off northwest India, and this at the same time that what appears to be another huge city has been found, as we discussed earlier, in much deeper water off the coast of Cuba. That means we're dealing with a worldwide phenomenon. And it's not surprising that the information is coming out now, because it's only within the last 50 years that we've had the technology to research underwater.
So the clock is ticking.
So the clock is ticking, and as more and more of these discoveries come in front of the public eye and the public become aware of them, it becomes harder and harder to maintain the existing picture of history. And eventually the breakthrough will come, and then we'll get into some very interesting inquiries.
Rather like the entire UFO issue.
Yes,
we're knocking at the door here.
Another issue which is knocking at the door. Many things are knocking at the door.
Yeah.
Our whole concept of what we are and why we're here, that's what's up for grabs. That's what's at the stake, the high stakes at the heart of all this, is what is it to be a human? What does it mean? These are the big questions.
But the value of human life seemingly on the decline again in terms of these international corporate giants who wage wars in the name of energy.
This is the terrible thing. And again, if you go back to the ancient texts, this is the dilemma that a lost civilization of the past also seems to have found itself in. Where there is an evil tendency in the society that leads to the destruction and the and to ignoring the value of human life. When human beings do that, when we ignore the value of life itself, then we're definitely on the road to ruin. That's what the ancient traditions say again and again and again all around the world. And so we're in a dangerous time now, but we're also in a time when the choices that we make as individuals can have an impact, I think.
Are we socially genetically engineered to self-destruct? Do we have a lemming issue about this society that, in the hands of the tyrants who are running the show, that proclivity seems to surface again?
Well, this is where the issue of knowledge is so important.
That knowledge is the most powerful weapon on the planet.
Yeah, it is. And we become lemmings when we're deprived of knowledge. We become, the less knowledge we have, the more easily led we are. The less independent we are, and the less independently we function, and therefore the more predictable we are. So we can understand why there is control of knowledge over not just the modern world, but over the ancient world as well.
Indeed.
And that this control is insidious and to be resisted.
To be resisted as best we can, and that's what we're doing. We're using the Internet for that now, but my friend, I worry greatly about the future of the Internet. It is so easily controlled by those who would seek to dumb it down.
Absolutely. No, I can see it happening. It's happening now.
We're going to break here, but in Europe, there is talk, as you saw at Rents.com in the last week, of new legislation banning hate on any websites which may even link to what is called hate. I mean, we'll talk about a subjective issue to abuse and misuse. There it is. Stand by. We'll be right back with Graham Hancock. A little quote from Graham Hancock's introductory remarks to his new book, Underworld. Yeah, he says, let me pick a good spot to be. I like this passage, Graham.
Mm-hmm.
What if we are a species with amnesia? I would parenthetically add, enforced amnesia, a distinct possibility, too.
Mm-hmm.
After all, scientists are now pretty sure that anatomically modern humans, just like us, have been around for at least 120,000 years. Yet our, quote, history begins but 5,000 years ago with the first cities and the first written records. And the prehistory of this process has presently only been traced back, often quite tentatively, to the end of the last ice age around 10,000 years ago, when it's thought that mankind began to make the transition from hunter-gathering to food production. So what were we doing during the previous 110,000 years? End quote. It's a marvelous way to draw people's attention to what Underworld is about, and before that
thing,
yes, of the gods. I love that expression. So what were we doing the previous 110,000 years ago?
Exactly. Were we just sitting on our thumbs?
That's right. And there's a book I mentioned on the program over the years called A Canticle for Leibowitz, which traces the repeating cycles of a civilization arising, becoming sated and glutted with knowledge and greed, and then doing itself in, ultimately destroying itself, usually with nuclear weapons or some other kind of biological devices.
That's right.
It is certainly within the realm of possibility, is it not, that we have had repeating cycles of civilization, maybe dozens of them? Who knows?
I'm convinced this is the case. I'm certain that this has been what has happened, and that over the next 40 or 50 years, the whole of humanity will become aware of this. We're at the turning point.
Aware or extinct?
Well, that's the other thing. I think this is where the question touches so relevantly on the present state of the world. One does not need to be a genius to look around the world to see that something has gone terribly wrong.
We have the means right now, Graham. I'm not talking about nuclear weapons. I'm talking about biological weapons, and now nanotechnology is opening yet other avenues of utter annihilation of all living forms on the planet. I mean, with an organism, in some cases a nanotechnology device that is just a few atoms in size, self-replicating, whose job it is to deconstruct human living tissues, and that's what it does. And these things are sitting around, and folks, we're that close to losing another cycle here and having to start all over again.
Yeah, we're a society with great knowledge and no wisdom.
Thank you. But the intelligence and wisdom, words don't necessarily always accompany one another.
They don't. They don't. And this is the tragedy of modern science. But on the one hand, it has proved to be such a fine instrument for understanding the physical world that we live in. But on the other hand, it's been harnessed to such narrow and mean-minded pursuits.
True. You're being charitable. Narrow and mean-minded. I'd go a lot further than that. Abraham in Hot Springs, Arkansas is online. He'd like to ask a question of Graham Hancock. Hello, Abraham. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Good evening. How are you gentlemen doing?
Fine.
I have two questions, if I may ask.
Go ahead.
The first question is, due to the possible regeneration of Earth's natural chemistries and everything, what are the chances of the pole shifts and everything happening within the next, 15, 20 years or whatnot?
Yeah. Do you want to answer that question first?
Let's take that one first.
I don't regard myself as a prophet of doom. That's not what I'm here to do. But I do listen to what ancient civilizations had to say, and it remains the case that a very large amount of ancient testimony in myth and tradition focuses our attention on the period that we live in today as a period of great danger and cataclysmic change. And that coincides with I think the instincts of millions of people around the world that something has gone terribly wrong with the world that we live in. So I don't dismiss those warnings at all. I think there's something to them.
Okay.
My second question would be a little left-wing kind of. I kind of break from the mainstream a lot, and like a lot of others. And possibly, either like evolution and everything, like from the Neanderthalic or Magnus or Erectus or whatnot, the processes of evolution could have been, what's the possibility of sprouting in the past 300 years a new advancement of evolution of human species?
That's
how that pertains to the subject. It's basically the stress of the systems, the social systems, the ecological systems, would create a new advancement of human species.
Well, it may or may not be that as the cause, but some are suggesting there is a different kind of young person now growing up that is not quite like the old style.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Mind you, the older generation has said that since time began.
That's not a new theme, but there are
some... The youngsters out there, they're not doing things the way we used to do them. No, it's true. I mean, there is that. But this question of evolution is interesting because unlike other animal species on the planet, we have the choice to evolve socially. We have the choice to affect our destiny as a species through deliberate planning of actions. And maybe what's needed is not so much a physical adaptation as some kind of mental adaptation to the new conditions that we live in today, which are radically different from anything, as far as we know, that human beings have ever experienced before.
As far as we know, indeed. Thank you, Abraham, very much. We have to roll into a break now. We'll do that and come right back. 800-876-4123. Graham Hancock. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along. And do visit Rentz.com. That's RENSE.com for news from around the world, around the clock, for people who seek outstanding information. So, all right, we're back. Graham Hancock, with your masterful grasp of history and your perspective of it all, it must really... And from what we've been talking about tonight about potential recurring cycles of civilization which have imploded upon themselves at the end, in watching the world as it is now being administered by the powers in charge, we see nothing less than rape, pillage, plunder of the environment, of the people on the planet, of the animal species. Everywhere you turn, there's really almost nothing but bad news, horrifying news in some ways, catastrophic news and others, that the fuse has been lit. And yet the globalist cartels that are running most of the show, the New World Order, whatever you want to call them, show no signs whatever about awareness or a desire to slow that raping, that pillaging, that destruction of the Earth's environment, or the destruction of our own nests. They show no signs of wanting to really, truly slow the course, to change the course, to do anything to try to reverse the degradation. It's almost as if they, at the very top, in some isolated cell or echelon of information, know something, that something's coming, and that it doesn't really matter. Or are they so stupid as to kill the goose that lays them all the golden eggs?
Well, you know, there's another answer, although it touches on mysticism. Which is, if you go back into the ancient traditions that came down to us out of ancient Egypt and the Gnostic version of early Christianity that's competed with early Christianity, these ancient ideas suggest the existence in the universe of a power of evil and of a power of good, and that human beings are the focal point of a cosmic struggle between darkness and light, between good and evil.
Well, Edgar Cayce certainly talked about that.
He did indeed, and again, that's an interesting point about Cayce, because by all accounts, he was not widely educated in ancient texts, and yet he knew.
He was a devoutly religious man in a traditional.
He was a devoutly religious man, and some of what he said touches on religious traditions that he supposedly was not aware of. So you know, this adds to. To the authenticity there, but the point being that many people accept that the existence of a god in this ancient tradition, it was almost seen as a dualistic system, that there were two supernatural beings, and that one of these was devoted to evil, and that the choices that human beings make can either strengthen or weaken the power of evil. And everything that you're talking about the way the world is run for the narrow interest of a small minority, and the way that the mass of us are kept in darkness and asleep, could be explained by that model too.
Indeed.
We just don't know. We're dealing with a subject that we actually don't know how deep and how far it goes.
Well, you look at the vacuuming of sea life for commercial gain. I mean,
really, as a diver, I'm very conscious of this.
Yeah, all right.
That our oceans, yes, you're absolutely right, that our oceans, that the contents, the fish, the wonderful variety of life under the sea is just being vacuumed up and stuffed onto our dinner plate as though it's a an endless resource. It's not an endless resource.
And then last week, I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, we have this horrible vision, a news story of the United States introducing a bill at a major world conference for the resumption of ivory trade. What is going on here? I mean,
it's absolutely extraordinary how anybody, after the experiences we've had, could encourage or support such a ridiculous and unnecessary violence against nature.
They're not speaking for me, those people.
No, they're not. They're not speaking for me either, and they're not speaking for millions of people out there. But these things get done anyway, because all of us at an individual level feel that we can't control what's happening. I wonder if that's the place to focus on making things better.
I don't know. I really don't know. I'm doing what I can do. You're doing what you can do. That's really all we can do. We're using every tool at our disposal. You can't do any more than that except...
Yeah. Well, that's why I hope that this inquiry into prehistory and into the possibility of a lost civilization and into the hard evidence for a lost civilization will be taken further, will continue to be a focus of interest for people around the world because it's there when we lost our memory way back there 12,000 years ago that we became susceptible to all this manipulation. Once we recapture our memory and know where we came from and what our true story is, we'll all be much more powerful and much more able to resist, I think.
I intensely look forward to the day when an archaeological discovery will be made which is more than a smoking gun, which doesn't get secreted away somewhere, which was brought out into the light of day.
Much of it is already under our noses. There is so much evidence out there which is simply bypassed at the moment. I mean, another issue that I go into in the book, and I'm just looking at some pages of Underworld at the moment, is this mysterious issue of ancient maps which actually show the world as it looked during the Ice Age. I tried to do a totally new study of this mystery based, again, on the latest scientific evidence. There is an area in which science and the alternative interpretation of the past can work together. And that's what I tried to do.
The Piri Reis map is really mind-boggling.
We were talking about the Bimini Road a few moments ago. I show that the famous Piri Reis map contains within it a map of the Grand Bahama Banks as they looked during the last Ice Age, 10 or 12,000 years ago.
Oh, fascinating.
There is an island, which I call a ghost island, on that map, which is in exactly the right position for the Grand Bahama Banks, which is the right size for the fully exposed Grand Bahama Banks, and even has, when you get down close detail and magnify the map, it even shows the structures of the Bimini Road on that island.
Really?
Yes. And this is the point that I'm making, that there are so many maps of this kind. The Cantina World Map of 1501 being another example, which shows India as it looked 15,000 years ago, which shows Southeast Asia as they looked 15,000 years ago. We can know this now because of good work done by scientists in the field of geology, which can reconstruct any coastline as it looked at any time in the last 20,000 years.
Well,
what we discover is that there was an earlier culture that was so advanced that it was capable of accurately mapping and measuring the world more than 15,000 years ago. And yet, that civilization has now vanished.
Antarctica?
Antarctica appears again and again on these maps, long before it was supposedly even discovered. I mean, again, this investigation goes back to the pioneering work of Charles Hapgood in the 1960s with maps of the ancient sea kings. But what I've tried to do is to add a whole new level of knowledge to this. This subject.
Hapgood and Velikovsky were two giants of the 50s and 60s.
Indeed, they were.
They're almost unknown now. Let's catch another call here very quickly while we still have a few minutes left. George is calling in from Ohio. Hello, George. Welcome back.
Hi, Jeff. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Hi, Mr. Hancock.
Hi, George.
I admire your work a lot and have followed it before.
Thank you.
And you know, with what's going on in the world right now, we may be getting ready to have a thermonuclear war.
I believe that is very possible and a terrifying and ghastly prospect.
What do you think if someone pulled a string and all of a sudden we got zero point energy or free energy? Do you think it would turn the situation around, or do you think the military would use this to their advantage only, And
I think the latter. I think the military would seek to use it to their advantage. That any source of new power or energy tends to be captured by the powers that be.
Yeah. Before it even rears its head, it's taken.
Before it even rears its head, because this is all part of this insidious mechanism of control that operates in our societies today. We think we're free, but we're not. We're controlled in everywhere, everything we do, every step we take, every thought we think.
And it's getting worse.
Yeah.
From day one.
How many cameras in the UK, video cameras are on the streets and on buildings
now? This is truly, a truly Big Brother type of experience.
Millions of them. And
you cannot move anywhere on the roads of the UK without being filmed by a camera now.
The average socially mobile citizen of the UK is, I think I read, photographed or imaged something like a factor of several hundred times a day.
Oh, yes.
A day.
Definitely.
Amazing.
Definitely. An extraordinary level of surveillance.
Yeah.
And yet it becomes taken for granted, and, you know, reasons are given why it's necessary to do this, and everybody just accepts it and doesn't think about what's actually going on here, which is that a small group of people are exerting control over every aspect of our daily lives.
Look how Europe was sold out. All the independent nations with all of their history pushed into the EU almost as if it was done by sleight of hand.
Weird, isn't it?
It's totally weird. George, thanks for calling.
Thanks, George.
We just have about a minute and a half left. Graham, what would you like to leave us with? Anything
well,
to wrap
it's
it up?
Been, it's been nice to talk to you tonight, Jeff. And,
well, thank
and,
you.
I would like to say that this book, Underworld, The Mysterious Origins of Civilization, is the last book that I'm going to write on the subject of a lost civilization. I feel that I've taken this subject with this new book as far as I, as one individual, can take it. I've tried to present hard evidence from all around the world, from China, from Japan, from India, from the Mediterranean, from the Atlantic, that there are ruined structures underwater that simply do not fit into our existing picture of history.
Right, yeah.
And that when you marry this all together with the myths and the traditions and with these astonishing ancient maps that show the world as it looked during the Ice Age, there's no other conclusion you can reach than that we have lost a huge part of our history and that it's definitely important.
Well, we've probably lost the majority of it.
Yes, yeah, as you know, there's this whole issue of what were we doing during the 110,000 years before we established.
That's a great line. I don't know if they're legitimate or not, but the late Dr. Cabrera's stones of Ica, with all of those incredible carvings on them, what was that?
Yes, I know. Another fantastic anomaly.
Truly.
These anomalies are gradually all fitting into a picture, and that picture is going to change the way we look at our ourselves.
Last very quick question. As you traveled around America, was there anything in particular that people tended to ask you more often than not?
I think it's more and more this feeling that are we about to confront a terrible cataclysm?
And mass anxiety.
Yes.
Indeed.
Mass anxiety.
Thank you, Graham, for getting up and spending 3 hours of your valuable
time. My pleasure.
It's
been fun. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Indeed.
Thanks a lot.
Good night.